Hello and welcome to Pets Plus Us, a weekly program of information and stories about the companions in our lives, our pets. I'm Mary DeFranco, your host for Pets Plus Us. Coming up this half hour, cardiologist Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers discuss what animals can teach us about health, the health and science of healing, in their book, Zubiquity. From time to time, my cats, being cats, have graphically displayed their keen hunting skills inside the house. In the winter, when the temperature outside drops, a chilled family of mice has found its way into our basement and set up a little household of their own down there, apparently thinking they were safe and sound for the winter, but not for long. The cats in the house inevitably discover the tiny squatters, and the hunt is on. I've gotten up for a few mornings to find a dead mouse on the landing, and I've been baffled that the mice were not outwardly injured. No blood or other signs of injury at all, and yet they were dead as a doornail. I even rescued one of the tiny critters that had made it through the ordeal, still alive, put it in a carefully vented box, and took it to the outdoors to set it free. But by the time we arrived, the mouse had died anyway. I had heard somewhere that cats, especially domesticated and well-fed ones, actually enjoy simply playing around with the mice without injuring them until the mice die on their own of heart failure, merely from the experience of being so terrorized. I've also learned that rabbits can be stressed to heart failure by being put in a bath, something that rabbits generally find terrorizing. Well, a book by Barbara Natterson-Horowitz, MD, and Catherine Bowers called Zubiquity explains this condition of heart failure from extreme stress in animals, including humans, as well as many other medical conditions that all primates, including humans, have in common. It reminds us how similar humans are to all primates, and it makes a case for the physicians of human and veterinary medicine to collaborate and to share the medical similarities that can benefit all species. Here are some excerpts from the book, starting with an introduction on the jacket and then from the chapter, Dr. House, Meet Dr. Doolittle. In the spring of 2005, cardiologist Barbara Natterson-Horowitz was called to consult on an unusual patient, an emperor tamarin at the Los Angeles Zoo. While examining the tiny monkey's sick heart, she learned that wild animals can die of a form of cardiac arrest brought on by extreme emotional stress. It was a syndrome identical to a human condition, but one that veterinarians called by a different name and treated in innovative ways. This remarkable medical parallel launched Natterson-Horowitz on a journey of discovery that reshaped her entire approach to medicine. She began to search for other connections between the human and animal worlds. Do animals get breast cancer, anxiety-induced fainting spells, sexually transmitted diseases? Do they suffer from obsessive-compulsive disorder, bulimia, addiction? The answers were astonishing. Dinosaurs suffered from brain cancer. Koalas catch chlamydia. Reindeer seek narcotic escape in hallucinogenic mushrooms. Stallions self-mutilate. Gorillas experience clinical depression. Joining forces with science journalist Catherine Bowers, Natterson-Horowitz employs fascinating case studies and meticulous scholarship to present a revelatory understanding of what animals can teach us about the human body and mind. Zubiquity is the term the authors have coined to refer to a new species-spanned approach to health, delving into evolution, anthropology, sociology, biology, veterinary science, and zoology. They break down the walls between disciplines, redefining the boundaries of medicine. Zubiquity explores how animal and human commonality can be used to diagnose, treat, and heal patients of all species, both authoritative and accessible, offering cutting-edge research through captivating narratives. This provocative book encourages us to see our essential connection to all living beings. And here is chapter one, entitled Dr. House, Meet Dr. Doolittle. Redefining the boundaries of medicine. In the spring of 2005, the chief veterinarian of the Los Angeles Zoo called me, an urgent edge to his voice. Listen, Barbara, we've got an emperor tamarin in heart failure. Any chance you could come out today? I reached for my car keys. For 13 years, I'd been a cardiologist treating members of my own species at the UCLA Medical Center. From time to time, however, the zoo veterinarians asked me to weigh in on some of their more difficult animal cases. Because UCLA is a leading heart transplant hospital, I'd had a front row view of every type of human heart failure. But heart failure in a tamarin, a tiny, non-human primate? That I'd never seen. I threw my bag in the car and headed for the lush 113-acre zoo nestled along the eastern edge of Griffith Park. Into the tiled exam room, the veterinary assistant carried a small bundle wrapped in a pink blanket. "This is Spitzbuben," she said, lowering the animal gently into a plexiglass front examination box. My own heart did a little flip. Emperor tamarins are, in a word, adorable. But this, about the size of kittens, these monkeys evolved in the treetops of Central and Southern American rainforests. Their wispy white Fu Manchu-style mustaches droop below enormous brown eyes. Swaddled in the pink blanket, staring up at me with that liquid gaze, Spitzbuben was pushing every maternal button I had. When I'm with a human patient who seems anxious, especially a child, I crouch close and open my eyes wide. Over the years, I've seen how this can establish a trust bond and put a nervous patient at ease. I did this with Spitzbuben. I wanted this defenseless little animal to understand how much I felt her vulnerability, how hard I would work to help her. I moved my face up to the box and stared deep in her eyes, animal to animal. It was working. She sat very still, her eyes locked on mine through the scratched plastic. I pursed my lips and cooed. "So, brave little Spitzbuben." Suddenly, I felt a strong hand on my shoulder. "Please stop making eye contact with her." I turned. The veterinarian smiled stiffly at me. "You'll give her capture myopathy." A little surprised, I did as instructed and got out of the way. Human-animal bonding would have to wait, apparently, but I was puzzled. Capture myopathy? I'd been practicing medicine for almost 20 years and had never heard of that diagnosis. Myopathy, sure, that simply means a disease that affects a muscle. In my specialty, I see it most often as cardiomyopathy, a degradation of the heart muscle. But what did that have to do with capture? Just then, Spitzbuben's anesthesia took effect. Time to intubate, the attending veterinarian instructed, focusing every person in the room on this critical and sometimes difficult procedure. I pushed capture myopathy out of my mind to be fully attentive to our animal patient. But as soon as we were finished and Spitzbuben was safely back in her enclosure with the other tamarins, I looked up capture myopathy. And there it was. In veterinary textbooks and journals going back decades. There was even an article about it in Nature from 1974. Animals caught by predators may experience a catastrophic surge of adrenaline in their bloodstreams, which can poison their muscles. In the case of the heart, the overflow of stress hormones can injure the pumping chambers, making them weak and inefficient. It can kill, especially in the case of cautious and high-strung prey animals like deer, rodents, birds, and small primates. And there was more. Locking eyes can contribute to capture myopathy. To Spitzbuben, my compassionate gaze wasn't communicating, "You're so cute, don't be afraid, I'm here to help you." It said, "I'm starving, you look delicious, I'm going to eat you." Though this was my first encounter with the diagnosis, parts of it were startlingly familiar. Cardiology in the early 2000s was abuzz with a newly described syndrome called Takotsubo cardiomyopathy. This distinctive condition presents with severe crushing chest pain and a markedly abnormal EKG, much like a classic heart attack. We rush these patients to an operating suite for an angiogram, expecting to find a dangerous blood clot, but in Takotsubo cases, the treating cardiologist finds perfectly healthy, clean coronary arteries. No clot, no blockage, no heart attack. On closer inspection, doctors notice a strange light bulb-shaped bulge in the left ventricle. As the pumping engines for the circulatory system, ventricles must have a particular ovoid, lemon-like shape for strong, swift ejection of blood. If the end of the left ventricle balloons out, as it does in Takotsubo hearts, the firm, healthy contractions are reduced to inefficient spasms, floppy and unpredictable. But what's remarkable about Takotsubo is what causes the bulge. Seeing a loved one die, being left at the altar, or losing your life savings with a bad roll of the dice. Intense, painful emotions in the brain can set off alarming, life-threatening physical changes in the heart. This new diagnosis was proof of the powerful connection between heart and mind. Takotsubo cardiomyopathy confirmed a relationship many doctors had considered more metaphoric than diagnostic. As a clinical cardiologist, I needed to know how to recognize and treat Takotsubo cardiomyopathy, but years before pursuing cardiology, I had completed a residency in psychiatry at the UCLA Neuropsychiatric Institute. Having also trained as a psychiatrist, I was captivated by the syndrome, which lay at the intersection of my two professional passions. That background put me in a unique position that day at the zoo. I reflectively placed the human phenomenon side by side with the animal one. Emotional trigger, surge of stress hormones, failing heart muscle, possible death. An unexpected aha suddenly hit me. Takotsubo in humans and the heart effects of capture myopathy in animals were almost certainly related, perhaps even the same syndrome with different names. But a second, even stronger insight quickly followed this aha. The key point wasn't the overlap of the two conditions, it was the gulf between them. For nearly four decades and probably longer, veterinarians had known this could happen to animals, that extreme fear could damage muscles in general and heart muscles in particular. In fact, even the most basic veterinary training includes specific protocols for making sure animals being netted and examined don't die in the process. Yet here were the human doctors in early 2000 trumpeting the finding, savoring the fancy foreign name, and making academic careers out of a discovery that every vet student learned in the first year of school. These animal doctors knew something we human doctors had no clue existed. And if that was true, what else did the vets know that we didn't? What other human diseases were found in animals? So I designed a challenge for myself. As an attending physician at UCLA, I see a wide variety of maladies. By day on my rounds, I began making careful notes of the conditions I came across. At night, I combed veterinary databases and journals for their correlates, asking myself a simple question: do animals get fill in the disease? I started with the big killers. Do animals get breast cancer, stress-induced heart attacks, leukemia? How about melanoma, fainting spells, chlamydia? And night after night, condition after condition, the answer kept coming back yes. The similarities clicked into place. Jaguars get breast cancer and may carry the BRCA1 genetic mutation that predisposes many Jews and of Ashkenazi descent and others to the disease. Rhinos in zoos get leukemia. Melanoma has been diagnosed in the bodies of animals from penguins to buffaloes. Western lowland gorillas die from a terrifying condition in which the body's biggest and most critical artery, the aorta, ruptures. Torn aortas also killed Lucille Ball, Albert Einstein, and the actor John Ritter, and strikes thousands of less famous human beings every year. I learned that koalas in Australia are in the middle of a rampant epidemic of chlamydia, Yes, that kind, sexually transmitted. Veterinarians there are racing to produce a koala chlamydia vaccine. That gave me an idea. Doctors around the United States are seeing human chlamydia infection rates spike. Could the koala research inform human public health strategies? Since unprotected sex is the only kind koalas have, my searches for condom use by animals came up short. What might those koala experts know about the spread of sexually transmitted diseases in a population that practices nothing but unsafe sex? I wondered about obesity and diabetes, two of the most pressing health concerns of our time. I burned midnight pixels investigating questions like, do wild animals get medically obese? Do animals overeat or binge eat? Do they hoard food and eat in secret in the night? I learned that yes, they do. Comparing animal grazers, gorgers, and regurgitators to human snackers, diners, and dieters transformed my view on conventional human nutrition advice and on the obesity epidemic itself. Very quickly, I found myself in a world of surprising and unfamiliar new ideas, the kinds I'd never been encouraged to entertain in all my years of medical training and practice. It was frankly humbling, and I started to see my role as a physician in a new way. I wondered, shouldn't human and veterinary doctors be partnering along with the wildlife biologists in the field, the lab, and the clinic? Maybe such collaborations would inspire a version of my Takotsubo moment, but for breast cancer, obesity, infectious disease, or other concerns. Perhaps they would even lead to cures. The more I learned, the more a tantalizing question started creeping into my thoughts. Why don't we human doctors routinely cooperate with animal experts? As I searched for that answer, I learned something surprising. We used to. In fact, a century ago or two, in many communities, animals and humans were cared for by the same practitioner. The town doctor, as he set broken bones and delivered babies, was not deterred by the species barrier. A leading physician of that era named Rudolf Virchow, still renowned today as the father of modern pathology, put it this way. Between animal and human medicine, there is no dividing line, nor should there be. The object is different, but the experience obtained constitutes the basis of all medicine. However, animal and human medicine began a decisive split around the turn of the 20th century. Increasingly urbanization meant fewer people relied on animals to make a living. Motorized vehicles began pushing work animals out of daily life. With them went a primary revenue stream for veterinarians, and in the United States, federal legislation called the Morrill Land Grant Acts of the late 1800s relegated veterinary schools to rural communities, while academic medical centers rapidly rose to prominence in wealthier cities. As the golden age of modern medicine dawned, there was simply more money, prestige, and academic reward to be had in pursuing human patients. For physicians, this era all but erased their tarnished image as the leech purveyors and potion makers of times past. But veterinarians enjoyed little to none of this skyrocketing social status and its accompanying wealth. The two fields moved through the 20th century for the most part on divided yet parallel paths. Until 2007. That's when a veterinarian named Roger Marr and a physician, Ron Davis, arranged a meeting in East Lansing, Michigan. They compared notes on similar problems they encountered in their animal and human patients: cancer, diabetes, the adverse effects of secondhand smoke, and the explosion of zoonosis, diseases that spread from animals to humans like West Nile virus and avian flu. They called for physicians and veterinarians to stop segregating themselves based on the species of their patients and start learning from one another. Because Davis was president of the American Medical Association, the AMA, and Marr headed the American Veterinary Medical Association, the AVMA, their meeting carried more weight than the handful of previous attempts to reunify Fields. But the Davis-Marr announcement received little notice in popular media or even among medical professionals, especially physicians. The truth is that most physicians will go through their entire careers never interacting with veterinarians, at least not professionally. Until I started consulting at the zoo, the only time I even thought about animal doctors was when I brought my own dogs in for an exam or vaccination. My veterinary colleagues tell me they regularly read human medical journals to keep up on the latest research and techniques. But most physicians I know, including myself until recently, would never dream of consulting an animal-focused monthly, even one as highly respected as the Journal of Veterinary Internal Medicine. I think I know why. Most physicians see animals and their illnesses as somehow different. We humans have our diseases. Animals have theirs. And I suspect there is another reason. The human medical establishment has an undeniable, though unspoken, bias against veterinary medicine. Among physicians, welcoming animal doctors as peers just isn't done. As Darwin shrewdly observed, we do not like to consider animals our equals. And yet, all of biology, the foundation of medicine itself, relies on the fact that we are animals. Indeed, we share the vast majority of our genetic code with our other creatures. And of course, on some level, we accept this vast biological overlap. Almost every medicine we take and prescribe has been tested on animals. Indeed, if you asked most physicians what animals can teach us about human health, there is one place they would automatically point: the lab. But that is precisely not what I am talking about. This book isn't about animal testing, nor is it about the complex and important ethical issues of lab animal investigation. Instead, it introduces a new approach that could improve the health of both human and animal patients. This approach is based on a simple reality. Animals in jungles, oceans, forests, and our homes sometimes get sick, just as we do. Veterinarians see and treat these illnesses among a wide variety of species. And yet physicians largely ignore this. That's a major blind spot, because we could improve the health of all species by learning how animals live, die, get sick, and heal in their natural settings. Of course, human beings are unique as a species, contained in our mere 1.4% genetic difference from chimpanzees are the physical, cognitive, and emotional features responsible for Mozart, the Mars rover, and the study of molecular biology itself. But the magnificent glare of this crucial but tiny percentage blinds us to our 98.6% sameness. Ubiquity encourages us to look away for a moment from the obvious yet narrow range of differences and embrace the many enormous similarities. Sadly, Spitzbuben the Tamarin later died. Not, I hasten to add, because of my attempt to befriend her. After her necropsy, the term for animal autopsy, I took a slide of some of her heart cells to one of the most respected cardiac pathologists in the country, a colleague of mine at UCLA, Michael Fishbein. As we peered through Fishbein's microscope, I noticed how the damaged heart muscle cells seemed ensnared and strangled by the surrounding tissue. I felt a jolt of dreadful recognition as I spotted familiar-looking pink and purple shapes illuminating in the glaring white circle of the microscope's frame. Although the abnormal cardiac cells belonged to a furry-tailed tree dweller, they were essentially identical to human heart cells with the disease. But this was more than a cellular display of our common ancestry with animals. The patterns illustrated a simple fact well known to veterinarians but unknown or ignored by modern physicians. Animals and humans share a vulnerability to the same infections, illnesses, and injuries. As he had done so many times before with human heart specimens, Fishbein studied the slide carefully before he spoke. Cardiomyopathy, I recall him observing, could be viral, looks just like a human's. His phrase contained the essence of ubiquity. Undistracted by fur and a tail, we saw under that microscope not heart disease in a tamarin, but rather heart disease in a primate, gorilla, gibbon, chimpanzee, tamarin, or human. As I heard Fishbein's words, my single species focus officially died. Emerging in its place was ubiquity, a connecting species-spanning approach to the diagnostic challenges and therapeutic puzzles of clinical medicine. I would never look at another heart, human, or animal the same way again. And that is chapter one, parts of chapter one of ubiquity. And now for that portion of the program I like to call Don't Eat That. This time, What to Do If Your Dog Eats Your Pot by Sarah V. Schweig. A video showing a Siberian husky named Loki after he accidentally ate marijuana is making news all over the world. It's like he's not even real, a voice can be heard saying at the end of the video, which shows a man trying to prop up Loki as his tongue dangles out of the side of his mouth. Stumbling, dilated eyes, and disorientation are signs that a dog has gotten into a secret stash. And sadly, this is happening more and more, and there isn't much that can be done for intoxicated animals. Marijuana toxicity is no laughing matter, and if people note their dogs have gotten into it, they should seek veterinary care immediately, Dr. Robert Proietto, a veterinarian in New York City, told the Dodo. It is also important to tell the veterinarian the truth. No veterinarian is going to judge their client for being honest, and we will never contact the police. We just want to know what is going on so we can treat the pet to the best of our ability. As we become legalized, run-ins between pets and pot could increase. In Washington State, for example, veterinarians have been seeing as many as a dog per day for THC exposure. And in Colorado, incidents of doped-up dogs have quadrupled in recent years. If you think your dog has overdosed on marijuana, take him to the veterinarian right away to make sure the dosage he ate isn't fatal. In all likelihood, his symptoms will disappear in a day or two, but when it comes to pets and drugs, you can never be too careful. The best thing to do if you partake is to keep your weed and marijuana-laced edibles far out of your dog's reach. And there is an update the Dodo heard from Loki's family, who want to assure everyone that Loki is doing fine after the incident, which was completely unintentional. You can read more about what happened at their blog about Loki at thedodo.com. And that'll do it for this week. Thank you for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the program. And as always, please spay and neuter your pets. It's healthy for them and the environment. Pets Plus Us is a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm your host, Mary DeFranco. If you'd like more information about this program or to hear this program again, visit our website at wxxi.org/reachout. I'd also like to invite you to share your pet story with us by writing to us at reachout@wxxi.org.